Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thanks for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Happy Monday to all of you. If you have not become an Undivided subscriber already, just, you know, join us. We have lots of fun on Wednesday. We talk shit about you guys every Wednesday. No, I'm kidding. We don't do that. But you wouldn't know, right, if you're not a subscriber, because we have the Wednesday show just for subscribers. You don't know what we might be talking about. You can become a subscriber for as little as $5 a month on Patreon, patreon.com/undivided, or by becoming a contributor on my locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. Coming up today, we're going to talk about farming in Washington State and the white savior complex of some Democratic senators when it comes to the rights of Hispanic farm workers. Also coming up, your reactions to my commentary on Matt Walsh. So Matt Walsh, he has been getting heat kind of from both sides. He's, of course, the Daily Wire conservative commentator. He's been getting heat from all sides about a commentary he did about trans activist Dylan Mulvaney. And whether it was just cruel or whether the harshness of it was necessary, you guys had a lot to say about that. So we'll end the show with some of your comments on that. Also, Amazon says it's going to be bringing workers back to the office 3 days a week. Why I think this is an absolute gift for the city of Seattle, one that voters need to make sure they take advantage of this year. But first, I want to start by just talking a little bit about efforts in Washington State, efforts nationally and really internationally to determine who the extremists are. And this has been something that, you know, we talked a lot about public safety, et cetera, the pursuit law, and that was sort of the priority in Washington State, this legislative session. But I also want to kind of refocus our efforts on some other things going on. And one of them is this law in Washington State, this proposed law that would establish a domestic violent extremist commission. We've discussed it a little bit on the podcast, but I'm going to spend some time this week on the show going in depth on it. But it's part of this really troubling trend of misguided efforts to peg people as extremist. So I remember, you know, when I talk about like internationally, there was this effort in New Zealand, there was this pamphlet put out telling citizens, hey, here are some signs that someone might be engaging in extremist behavior or maybe plotting a terror attack. And at the time that was released, New Zealand's spy chief also included during an interview or during comments she gave that it could also be people who were against New Zealand's strict COVID mandates.
And so it could be the COVID measures that the government took, or it could be other policies that are interpreted as infringing on rights. And it's a what I sometimes describe as a kind of hot mess of ideologies and beliefs fueled by conspiracy theories.
And so I thought, great, okay, so if you're against COVID mandates in New Zealand, which I'm going to New Zealand in March, the spy chief thinks you could be a domestic extremist. And then I was also watching Fox News the other day, and they were talking about this leaked FBI memo where the whistleblower who leaked it suggested that the FBI planned to spy on Catholics and how certain types of practicing Catholics could be an indicator of extremism, of domestic extremism. Spike Cohen, who's a libertarian, was on with Kennedy on Fox talking about this.
You can add crucifixes and rosary to the growing list of seemingly fine, normal objects that the FBI sees as terrorism. I remember last year when they released a report on so-called violent extremists, and they said that some of the things that people should be on the lookout for, that their agents should be on the lookout for, was the wording of the Second Amendment, the Betsy Ross flag, the original American flag, and the Tree of Liberty quote from Thomas Jefferson, one of the founders of the country. So even just acknowledging American history, according to our government, makes you a potential terrorist.
So anyway, that got me thinking about this current effort in Washington State to establish a domestic violent extremism commission. It's right now it's Substitute House Bill 1333, and this is something that's being pushed by Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. And essentially it would establish a domestic violent extremism commission within the office of the attorney general for the purpose of, quote, establishing a comprehensive public health and community-based framework for responding to domestic violent extremism. Okay. So it also says who would make up this extremism commission for legislators, split between Democrats and Republicans, a representative of the governor's office, a representative of the attorney general's office, a representative with expertise in public health appointed by the attorney general, six representatives from organizations representing groups protected under basically hate crime statutes. And it says they may include but not limited to a representative from the Black community, the Muslim community, the Jewish community, the Asian American community, the Sikh community, the Latino community, the LGBTQ community, a representative from the immigrant refugee community, someone from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the United States Department of Homeland Security, and a representative from a federally recognized tribe. Okay. So it says that the meeting would have, or the commission would have its first meeting before December 31st, 2023. Now, look, you might be wondering, okay, what's wrong with a commission to study domestic extremism? Surely it exists. It's because of my issue with this, and it's what I've articulated, and again, I'm going to do a deep dive in on this on Wednesday's episode, is we are ignoring in Washington State the most obvious type of extremists, the extremists who operate out in the open multiple times a year, extremists who have caused damage to businesses, extremists who have, you know, attempted to kill police officers, extremists who have harassed journalists, extremists who have lit police cars on fire, and extremists who have gone so far as to take over six square blocks of the city. And I'm talking about far left extremism. In Seattle, it's one of the only types of extremism that exists. And I realize that the Attorney General is really concerned about right wing extremism. I'm not saying that there's not any of that in Washington State. And certainly there could be stuff happening behind the scenes that the public isn't privy to. But when Democrats spend so much time actively ignoring clear cases of domestic terrorism on the streets of Seattle, like what we saw through much of the summer of 2020, I mean, you had rioters who were lighting construction trailers on fire, police cars on fire. You had rioters, criminals who attempted to light a police precinct on fire after trying to cement the door shut to kill the officers inside. You had rioters that summer who were setting off, throwing some sort of explosive device at the East Precinct, and you had absolute silence from Attorney General Bob Ferguson, from Democrats in Olympia, and from, frankly, the majority of the Seattle City Council on what was happening. And it's because it wasn't politically advantageous for them to speak out about that kind of obvious domestic extremism. I don't see you creating a commission to deal with that. And you might say, well, we can talk about it on this commission. Bullshit. We all know what this commission is going to be about. It's going to be about, quote, right-wing extremism. Well, you blatantly ignore, as you have done for the past decade, obvious cases of domestic violent extremism being carried out by the far left in Seattle, in Portland, in every space in between. So if you want me to think for one freaking second that this domestic violent extremism commission will actually look at the most obvious cases of domestic terrorism on the streets of our state, then I want you to actually acknowledge the existence of Antifa. I want you to actually acknowledge the violence and vandalism and destruction that has been carried out by the far left in Seattle for, as I said, a decade. If you come out, Attorney General Bob Ferguson, you acknowledge that, you say you're going to take it seriously, then yeah, I won't have a problem with your domestic violent extremism commission. But the thing is, I know that you won't do that. And so I know that this commission is going to be a complete and utter political sham. The following segment is presented in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. Starting on May 1st, Amazon says it's going to require its employees to work from the office at least 3 days a week. And this is really significant news. I mean, you know, beyond what it might mean for Amazon and its employees, downtown Seattle has been suffering. It was suffering before the pandemic. The pandemic only exacerbated it. All the people who would be down there daily for work, et cetera, they weren't there. And so you really only had this, you know, the people who were down there for nefarious reasons. You had people doing drugs, selling drugs, committing crimes, stealing from small businesses. And so the fact that Amazon is saying, okay, it's time to come back, it's time to work from the office, is a really significant development, and it's exactly what Seattle needs right now. But this really can't be an easy decision for Amazon, because it wasn't just, you know, and I'm sure they'll never admit this, but this is about more than just the pandemic changing how people in tech worked, and the the realization that you can work remotely. The decision to hold off so long on bringing people back to the Seattle campus, I know for a fact, also had to do with the state of downtown and crime. I mean, I have said over and over that to me, during this whole crime wave, one of the most disturbing pieces of video, one of the most disturbing crimes that I have seen happened to an Amazon engineer, a female, who was just walking down the sidewalk when a guy comes up behind her, sets down his bag calmly, winds up, hits her in the back of the head with a baseball bat as hard as he possibly could. I mean, I'm shocked that she survived it. And then you had an Uber driver who was shot and killed right outside the Amazon spheres. And so, you know, yes, Amazon, you know, pulled its workers from offices in downtown Seattle because of the pandemic. But I really do believe that a big part in not having that return to office sooner was because of the state of downtown. Now, it's a tough situation because Amazon knows that it and knew that it could be part of bringing downtown back to life if it sent its workers down there. But I cannot blame the company for saying we don't know or for believing we don't know if it's safe for them to be down there. I would also say that this is a gift from Amazon to the city of Seattle. This is a gift from Amazon to a city that has treated it poorly over the years. When you look back at when Amazon was thriving, Amazon is thriving, but pre-pandemic, everything was fine, you know, no work from home issues on the horizon. None of us knew what would happen. And you looked at the way that the city of Seattle treated Amazon as the enemy, truly as the enemy, you know, pushing through a tax on high-paying jobs, Amazon saying, okay, well, we're going to start moving jobs over to Bellevue then. And now at this critical moment for downtown Seattle, Amazon is again stepping up to help, is again stepping up to say, okay, we're going to bring workers back to the office 3 days a week. We're going to help revitalize and save downtown Seattle. And this is an opportunity for the city of Seattle to show some gratitude to Amazon, to treat Amazon as a partner in its success. This is a chance for the citizens of Seattle to, this year, 7 council seats on the ballot. This is a chance for the citizens of Seattle to also step up and say, okay, we don't want any of these anti-business council members to keep their jobs. We don't want to elect any new anti-business council members. We've seen what happens when you play games with our city's economic prosperity, when you vilify the city's largest employer. And it's not just about the success of Amazon as a company. It's also about the ability of all the businesses around Amazon to thrive. When you have a workforce of thousands and thousands of people, you require and you lift up a workforce of thousands and thousands of people that can support it. The restaurants, the bars, the coffee shops, the dry cleaners, the doggy daycares. All of those small businesses rely on the success of this one large business. They rely on their workforce being in Seattle, living in Seattle, working in Seattle, going into the office. And so to me, this is a second chance for Seattle to treat Amazon the way it deserves to be treated. Doesn't mean you have to roll over for them. It doesn't mean you let Amazon steamroll you. But Amazon has shown at every juncture that it wants to be a good corporate citizen, that it wants to help the city of Seattle thrive, that it wants to be part of Seattle's future. And instead of pushing it away, vilifying Amazon, demonizing Amazon, we can start a new chapter where we elect people to the Seattle City Council who care about the success of businesses big and small, where we elect people to the Seattle City Council who know that if Amazon pulls up stakes here, it will be disastrous for not only the city's economic prosperity, but for the economic prosperity of our entire state. And it's our chance to elect city council members who realize that if you do not make the city a welcoming place for business, it will not be a welcoming place for residents. It will not be a welcoming place for tourists. And we will continue this trajectory of handing the streets of our once beautiful city over to criminals. This year, more than ever, Seattle and Seattle voters get to decide what kind of city it's going to be, whether we can get on a path toward living up to our potential as a world-class city, or whether we're going to continue to go down the path that we've seen for the last 3 years. Again, Amazon is offering an olive branch with this return to office. They might say it's about, you know, business, internal operations, being able to function better as a company, and that's fine. I'm sure that has something to do with it. But in my estimation, it's also about trying to save downtown Seattle. I'm not sure city leaders deserve it, but the people of Seattle should embrace it, should be thankful to Amazon, and they should show Amazon through their votes this year that they do not intend to squander this opportunity to bring the city they love back to life. The previous segment was brought to you in partnership with Future 42. Turn your frustration into action at future42.org. So I'm getting ready to go to Adele, and I'm trying to pick out what I'm going to wear. And I was like, oh man, I need to look like elegant as hell for Adele in Vegas on Friday. And I went to my closet, and in the back of my closet, there was this, it's like this black velvet number, little dress with these flowers on it. And I haven't worn it in like 4 years. And I was like, what are the chances that that fits me again? And I tried that bad boy on. Fit me great. I looked smoking. It's what I'm wearing for Adele. So when I go to Adele, I'll take a picture and post it for you guys, because this dress is gorgeous and it hasn't fit me in years. But because I've been on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic plan since November, I'm down about 30 pounds now, 30 pounds. It fits me great. And I've been trying to encourage you guys, if you've been hearing these commercials that I've been doing and you're just thinking, well, maybe one day, just do it. Because the weight loss is so instantaneous. If you start right now and you follow the plan, and I mean really follow the plan, you got to stick to it. You can lose weight by summer. If you've got something coming up, you just want to be in good bikini shape. I mean, I lost so much weight in the first month. It was such a noticeable difference. So it can happen fast. So reach out to Dr. Coogan at EastsideWeightLossClinic.com, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. Schedule a free consultation. It's 15 minutes of your life. And then if you don't like the plan after he describes it to you, then you don't do it. But you just take 15 minutes to chat with him. You'll love him, I promise. And he'll talk a little bit about what the plan does. You know, it is, there's no prepackaged meals or anything like that. It's just cooking at home. You can find stuff out to eat. Is it magic? No, you're going to have to eat healthier. You're going to have to really commit to it. But if you do, I promise you'll be feeling better in no time. So again, schedule your free consultation, EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. That's EastsideWeightLossClinic.com. An issue we haven't talked a lot about on the podcast is food and farming. And I wish we would have been talking about it more sooner, because think about how many stories farming has been at the center of. I mean, our supply chain issues, you know, running out of food on the shelves, the cost of eggs, I mean, all these things. There was this interesting, and by interesting, I mean soul-sucking, debate in Olympia over a Senate bill, 5476. And essentially what the Senate bill, and it was proposed by a Republican, would do is it would make it so that for 12 weeks a year for farms in Washington state, they can have workers work up to 50 hours before overtime kicks in, as opposed to 40 hours and then overtime kicks in. And so basically what they're saying is they've got these 12 weeks a year where they've got the harvest going on. They need people to be there to work an extra, but they simply do not have the money to afford that extra overtime. And what they're saying is, and what farm workers are saying is, some farms have resorted to just bringing in more workers that they, and then spreading the work out so then they don't have to pay overtime to anyone. And so some farm workers are saying, hey, I'd rather have the 50 hours all to myself and not get overtime than have the extra hours given to someone else. So anyway, and here's Senator Curtis King, who is the bill's sponsor, explaining kind of the necessity of this.
When you think about farming, farmers don't control the weather. Farmers don't control the prices that they get for the products that they produce. We need to do something. We can't. They don't control. You think about a product on a tree, and all of a sudden the weather gets warm, and that fruit starts to ripen. They have a short period of time to get that fruit off of those trees to salvage their season that they've worked on all year long. So that's what this bill addresses, is allowing a farmer to have seasonality, 12 weeks at 50 hours before overtime kicks in. If you look at all of the other states that have implemented ag overtime, I believe all or very close to all of them have a seasonality issue. What we're asking for here is at the low end of what you see in all of these other states. I think it's a fair and equitable thing to do, not only for the farmer, but also for the worker as well.
So that's when, at this hearing, two very interesting things happened. And again, by interesting, I mean soul-sucking. And they demonstrate how the left brings everything back to race. Senator Karen Kaiser, she had a couple remarks during the hearing, basically saying that, you know, our current, you know, labor laws, our farming labor laws are akin to like forced labor of slaves and black people, generations ago in this country.
In the 1930s, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed by Congress, the Southern senators insisted that in order to get that bill done, they had to have an exemption for farm workers. Of course, those were mostly African-American farm workers in the South. But that exemption continued on for 60 years, and we are trying to address that inequity in this state, and I think we are making real progress, and I want to congratulate all of us for the progress we are making.
So that in and of itself is just ridiculous. I mean, to compare Washington State, like in any way, to the Deep South and our farming laws is insane, right? And again, it's just about like, oh, white, it's like this white savior complex. Like, oh, I'm going to save these Hispanic farm workers from the white man bad as this like white senator. It's just, it's bizarre. But then there was also, so there was some testimony given by farm workers in favor of this bill. They showed up in person for testimony. There was also some remote testimony, and some of them testified in Spanish. And Senator Rebecca Saldana, who's a Democrat on this particular committee, labor and commerce, I don't know if she took it upon herself or what, but she translated some of that testimony. And in particular, there was this translation that not only was it, did it exclude the fact that this farm worker had said he supported this Republican bill, but she also added her own comments onto the end of her translation in a way that was completely inappropriate. Listen.
Gracias por su testimonio. And again, just briefly saying that during the winter, it's really hard. There's not enough work. It's really hard to put the hours together. And so that's why when there is work, they need the extra hours. Being able to work 50 hours is what allows them to even survive. And it would be even more if they could work those extra 10 hours and have that be time and a half with overtime. And that's my comments, because it's really hard for me to translate when I know that they're not given all the information. Thank you.
So basically, you're too dumb to understand what this bill does. And totally butchering the translation, denigrating the person who offered the testimony, the farm worker who offered the testimony, like, oh, you know, it'd be really nice if you got paid those extra 10 hours. That's not what he said. He was saying he wanted 50 hours a week, and you should have just translated. If you're going to translate, you should have just translated what he said. So anyway, her comments sent the farm world into an absolute furious frenzy in Washington State. And I asked Dylan Honkoop. He grew up on a farm. He hosts the Real Food, Real People podcast. I asked him to come in and just talk about what's going on with farmers in our state and with this urgent need for more labor during periods of the year, and also to respond to what those two Democratic senators said. Dylan, welcome to Undivided.
Thanks for having me.
Tell people a little bit about your podcast.
So the Real Food, Real People podcast is all about sharing, as we say, the stories of the people behind our food. And a lot of those people are farmers, of course. But there are other people in our food system, too. The people processing the food, the people butchering, you know, chefs cooking food. It's getting their human stories, though, reconnecting people with the humanity that goes into their food. I think there's this perception that farming and food has become a product of a machine. And the food system is a big, evil, scary machine that you can't trust. And the reality, at least here in Washington State, is that's not true. There are still so many people in farms, you know, 95% of farms in the state are family owned and operated. So for people to be able to see that and not just, you know, learn, we like to cover little bits about, you know, how you milk a cow or how you harvest onions or whatever it might be. But beyond that information, get that real story of that person. They've been through a lot, just like anybody has. And then people can be like, hey, this person that's growing my food, like, they're like me. And they really care about what they're doing. It's a game changer as far as people understanding their food system and trusting the food that's grown here.
Yeah, and I really love, I was telling you this before we started, that you go to where they are. You know, sometimes you'll be at their farm, at a barn, outside. It's the Real Food, Real People podcast, and how can people watch it?
Just search that on your preferred platform if you want to listen on all the usual audio platforms, and then on YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, and I suppose I should be on others too. They always tell me, you know.
That's how I feel. TikTok, I'm like, I'm too old. I have no energy for TikTok.
Absolutely.
So why is this something that you are interested in? Talk about your background.
Well, I grew up as a farm kid here in Western Washington. Grew up on a small red raspberry farm. Both sets of my grandparents were in small dairy farms. So that was my life. After, you know, having a career in broadcast for several years, I had this opportunity to come back to the farming community with my communication stuff and be able to share those stories. That's what I was doing as a news person, was sharing people's stories. So this opportunity was incredible for me to come back to my community, the people I grew up with. I know how their general vibe works, how their farms kind of work. I like to learn a lot more about them. But it just fit me so perfectly to then be able to step in and share those stories with people who don't have access to that anymore. I mean, 50 years ago, people could get on a farm probably a lot more easily than now for a variety of reasons, but a lot of people just had relatives in it. Now, what is it? Less than 2% of the population grows our food. Very few people have that connection to someone actually doing it anymore.
And I love that you've taken that background and radio and translated it into this, because my favorite kinds of podcasts are the really specific, like, mission-driven podcasts. And so it's really interesting, and just watching a few clips, even if you're not into farming or a farmer, like you said, to kind of learn more about just the people in your communities who grow your food. So it's really, really a cool project and a cool show. So how much time, if any, do you spend? Because we met at the Washington State Farm Bureau convention where I was speaking this year. How much time do you spend advocating for farmers in Washington State? Or do you spend any time in Olympia?
I don't do lobbying per se. So I go to Olympia occasionally, but I try to stay away from that town, honestly. Sorry, Olympia folks, but it's not really my jam. I prefer to be out on the farm, you know, and really with the kind of stuff that I do, I could be anywhere in Washington State. So I travel all over the state to meet these farmers, interview people, find out what's going on the ground. And then, yeah, my advocacy is public outreach, letting people know the truth about what's happening with farming and our food system here in Washington State. Sadly, often the story isn't a good one about what the truth is about what's happening and the misunderstandings that are leading to some serious problems. And, you know, in the last couple of years, this has become so much more important for people. For the first time in our lifetime, we've seen empty shelves, you know, during the pandemic. And that was a wake-up call for a lot of people, like, oh, crap. Maybe I do need to care about where my food really comes from, beyond just the, like, bougie trends of, well, I need to make sure I get this or don't have that. Where your food, the staples, the stuff that nourishes your body and keeps you alive comes from is an important thing to us. And we're still talking about food security, you know, Ukraine and a lot of other factors that are happening now. People are like, I want to know, like, eggs, right?
The,
like,
why
are they so expensive?
You talked about bougie food trends. I wish I had gotten into the bougie food trend of getting your own chicken in your backyard, because I'd be making money hand over fist right now, selling eggs to all the neighbors.
Right.
You talked about, you know, some misunderstandings, and I want to get to, you know, kind of the crux of why we asked you in to talk about something that we said at a hearing in Olympia. But first, can you talk about 5476 was a bill that was introduced. My understanding of it is to really help make sure that these farmers have enough people and enough work to get their harvest done, so you don't have food that just sits on the vine or whatever it is. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of its Senate Bill 5476?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole idea is about farm workers, right? And making sure that the people who are harvesting our food, you know, food is one of these, and farming is one of these areas where it still requires a lot of hands-on, old school, get dirty and get, you know, the food harvested kind of labor. And you know, people are still working on robots and all that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of that stuff that will always be. And really, I want it. I would rather my food be picked by humans than robots. But the reality is, it's about taking care of those workers. And that's where this idea of overtime came to the fore a couple of years ago. There was a court case and then some ensuing legislation that rolled out overtime pay, time and a half pay, over a threshold for farm workers, ostensibly to help them make more money. The reality is they're making less money as a result of that because of the dynamics of that. And we can get into why that is.
Yeah.
But for farm workers, first and foremost, because again, that's what this whole overtime issue is about, is making sure they're well taken care of. They're clamoring for a change. They're saying, this doesn't work for me. This is hurting my family. It's making it hard for me to get by. I've gone backwards. We heard that from multiple people testifying on this bill. Let me work. Let us work is the refrain I've been hearing in the 2 years since this became law and they're rolling it out. Everywhere I go, workers are like, we don't want this. This is going to hurt us now. It is hurting them. So this bill would allow during a harvest season, and that's the other thing about farming that we have to get into here, that this is different than a factory job. This is different than working in an office.
You have a really busy, busy time of the year.
It's, yeah, a little less. It's seasonal and super busy at one time of the year. And the other side of the year, almost nothing to do, really, in depending on the farm and, you know, what you're doing. So this bill would allow people to get more hours during those busy seasons. That's the idea, very simply. It would allow a 12-week window to be decided by a farm where that threshold of where time and a half pay starts would go up to 50 hours rather than 40 hours. Sounds very simple. But to some people, that's an affront to this idea of overtime, which I understand that, again, if you work in a factory, if you work in an office, that's a different equation entirely. And so to them, it's ripping people off. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the law as it exists right now.
Yeah.
Is like it would be kind of for all of us, right? At 40 hours a week. Anything after that, you're getting time and a half.
And it's actually phasing in. So last year in 22, it was 55 was the threshold. This year, 23, the threshold is 48 hours. Next year, it will be 40. Okay. And that's where it will stay according to that 2021 decision by the state legislature.
And so is the argument from the farm community that if we have to start during this busy period paying time and a half at 40 hours, we can't afford it?
Absolutely. I mean, and particularly for the smaller farms. Their choice is right now, either they, and this is why people aren't able to make as much money. There's not enough money to pay that much more for those additional hours. So their choice is to bring on more people, take that pie that they have of, you know, dollars for hours, mm-hmm. and split it up between more people. So everyone gets a smaller piece of the pie. They're only getting 40 hours, or this year maybe up to 40 hours a week, so farms can stay in business. Because honestly, there are quite a few farms that would not make it if they had that increase in their labor costs. Their margins are just that tight.
So essentially, instead of paying these people an additional time and a half of 10 hours, we're just going to bring on other people that we can pay at a regular rate. And then so that's the complaint that some of these farm workers have, is like, well, hey, I want to, you know, be able to work and not have that money go to someone else, essentially.
Exactly.
So my understanding of the bill is it would raise that threshold, like you said, 50 hours for a set 12 weeks a year. I want to play for folks. I played it here coming into the interview, but again, there was some remote testimony and in-person testimony done by farm workers and farm advocates. And there was one in particular. So first of all, do you know why Senator Saldana was the one translating? Is that normal?
Not to my knowledge. She would have been probably the only bilingual person on that committee. So I can see where she would have stepped into that role. But she also has a background as a farm worker union organizer and activist. Mm. So she certainly has a vested political interest in this issue as well.
Not the person who should be advocating translating.
You know, whether they're on one side or the other, mm-hmm. those lawmakers need to be listening.
Yeah. So I'll play this clip again.
Gracias.
Gracias por su testimonio. And again, just briefly saying that during the winter, it's really hard. There's not enough work. It's really hard to put the hours together. And so that's why when there is work, they need the extra hours. Being able to work 50 hours is what allows them to even survive. And it would be even more if they could work those extra 10 hours and have that be time and a half with overtime. And that's my comments, because it's really hard for me to translate when I know that they're not given all the information. Thank you.
So you hear her there launch into this translation of what the farm worker said, rough translation as we come to find out.
Yeah.
But then she adds her own little piece at the end saying, well, I'm sure they'd really like the money if that extra 10 hours was time and a half. Talk about the reaction amongst, you know, the Farm Bureau and the farm community to her. The liberties she took with that translation.
I think the reaction was most immediate from the farm workers who were there and the farm workers who were watching as it happened, saying, what? We're trying to testify and share what's happening in our real lives, and you're interjecting yourself to put your thumb on the scale and put your opinion into someone else's testimony in a way that infers that workers don't know what they're talking about. These folks' lives.
That they've been fooled.
It's their. They're not stupid people. They're very smart. They work really hard. They know what's going on with their life and their budget. And yet the same person who claims to champion the underrepresented and minority communities, people of color, is the one who's then essentially suggesting they don't know what they're talking about, to the point where she needs to step in and insert her own opinion. I don't know, correct what folks were saying. It was bizarre.
Well, and she says she finds it hard to even translate when she feels like they're not being given all the information. Well, that's a pretty good indicator you probably shouldn't be translating for them then. But she also really critically left out, like I said, it turns out to have been a very loose a summary of what he said. And she left out the fact that he said, I support Senate Bill 5476, which was championed by a Republican.
Kind of an important part of the story
here. Detail.
I mean, that's why that person, Cesar Crescencio, I believe was the name of the worker where she decided to insert herself. She had translated a few other workers in similar fashion before without her editorializing. Why she had to step in there?
No, couldn't help herself.
Clearly, again, like you noted, she said there, I'm having a hard time translating, essentially because of her own political bias on this issue. And the other thing that needs to be pointed out is there was a state-certified translator in the room who had helped a different person who wanted to testify in Spanish earlier in the hearing. Mm. Where was that person?
That's
Why was that
question.
Person not being used? Why did someone with a very specific, strong political bent have to insert themselves when they were supposed to be the one listening and evaluating and actually hearing, maybe having their own opinions challenged? But instead of, and I think that's where all of us should be. You know, if you're in a hearing, you should be listening to people and saying, okay, that's your real lived experience. I'm going to listen to that rather than come at you with, you know, where my head is at. The point is, maybe there's something I don't understand. But instead she was telling them, they didn't understand.
Well, I think what's you mentioned lived experience, which the left uses that phrase all the time. And here you have this farm worker who is truly offering their lived experience.
Yeah.
And then you have the senator that says, oh, no, you don't understand what you're talking about. Let me tell you what your lived experience truly is. It's pretty remarkable. I know that the Washington State Farm Bureau asked for her to apologize. Do you know if she has?
I haven't heard anything. And I believe the Center Square reached out to her office and got no response. That's the most I've heard about it. But very disappointing, again, from someone who claims to champion this community, someone who was, you know, even on this issue, claiming to hold the moral high ground of she's the one looking out for folks' best interest. They're there saying what she has done and supported with this law and what she's now ultimately standing against is something that's hurting them. You know, what could have happened here is we could have injected a little more common sense into our state's laws. Don't do away, you know, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. We could still have some overtime, but have something that works and allows people to make more money.
Yeah. Well, let's also talk about Senator Kaiser, who's the chair of this committee. She interjected her own little sentiments at the very end, kind of got the final word on this. And, you know, in so many words, framed the existing laws around farm workers and pay as having roots in racism. Here's what she said.
Thank you, Senator King. And I'll just reiterate, in the 1930s, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed by Congress, the Southern senators insisted that in order to get that bill done, they had to have an exemption for farm workers. Of course, those were mostly African-American farm workers in the South. But that exemption continued on for 60 years. And we are trying to address that inequity in this state. And I think we are making real progress. And I want to congratulate all of us for the progress we are making.
So is that a fair assessment that some of these laws were born out of, you know, the Deep South and she says mostly black people were right. is that a fair sentiment?
I'm not an expert on that history, but from folks that are, they say, no, absolutely not. In fact, at that time, it was like 3-1 poor white people. We're talking Depression era, you know, the folks that were destitute and working hard in the field. This is a totally different era as far as labor standards and things that were going on in society.
Well, yeah, we can't compare Washington State 2023 to like the slave era in this country, the Great Depression era.
But that's what Senator Kaiser was doing and saying that's what she's apparently doing, the Lord's work of rooting this systemic racism out, when I'm struggling to even see the connection to where we are today. And keep in mind, you know, Senator Kaiser said that. We just talked about what Senator Saldana did inserting herself. Earlier in the hearing, Senator Kaiser also interjected herself and to clarify, inferring again that people testifying didn't understand the bill that they were commenting on.
I do want to clarify, there's no limit on the number of hours per se, just simply that after you work 40 hours, then overtime pay starts.
Yeah.
So just to clarify, because there's no mandate that you stop working at 40 hours.
Yeah, we weren't against paying overtime. We just want a little bit of flexibility so we could provide more hours to the guys. I mean, if I pay 20 hours of overtime to every guy I have, I'm going to go broke. We're going to go out of business. So we just want a little bit of help so we could be able to provide more hours.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, because when you employ 400 guys a week and you have to kick in the overtime, it's gonna hurt.
Which, again, is very disrespectful. There were several hearings in the overall session that, you know, the hour before that. No one ever suggested that someone, you know, it was heated testimony back and forth on a few different things having to do with, you know, rules for pot businesses. No one ever interjected to suggest in any way that someone commenting didn't know what they're talking about. But when it came to farm workers who were on a different political spectrum or, you know,
spoke a different language, like as if that makes them dumb.
Right.
Yeah.
And what else can you assume when someone is doing that? But then it should also be mentioned, you talk about this idea that was inserted at the very end by Senator Kaiser about racism. Keep in mind that Senator Saldana just a few years ago introduced a bill in Olympia in an attempt to force farmers to essentially report instances of slavery on their operations. What does that suggest? As if that would ever occur in current day Washington State. It's unbelievable, and it was offensive. Farming community remains offended by that move.
And if somebody did have slaves that they'd report to the government.
It's obvious it was intended to make a statement.
Right.
It was intended to create waves. And it did. And they were offensive.
Yeah. I guess, you know, the devil's advocate argument is, hey, this is how society works. We have to have laws in place to protect people, make sure they're paid fair wages. And 40-hour work week seems to be generally accepted. And so why would you say that for these farm workers, an extra 10 hours a week, they just have to suck it up and get normal pay?
My question first is, what are the workers themselves saying? What do they want? And why can't they be the authority on this issue of what's best for their lifestyle and for their budget? And they are very clearly saying, and this isn't just one, you know, handful of people. I travel the state. I've been hearing this now ever since this law was put in place all over. And people are, I think they don't even realize how many other people are on the same page as them with the same frustration, but they're saying the same story. They want more hours. They just want to work. They know that's how farming works. The farm owners, the farm managers, supervisors, the laborers, across the board during busy seasons, everybody just goes like, that's what I grew up doing. You know, during red raspberry harvest when I was a kid, we hardly left the farm during the month of July because that's when we were harvesting our raspberries. My dad made basically all of his income in 1 month. So every hour was crucial to the future of our family. They know that too. And they also enjoy the benefits of that. You know, I mentioned lifestyle. It's been this way since time immemorial, really, with farming and, you know, make hay when the sun shines. It's busy in certain times, slow in others. Those slow times are beneficial to them as well, particularly Hispanic farm workers who have family elsewhere and maybe they want to go visit. You know, it was very common for the people that I worked with when I was younger working in farming to take off for a few weeks in December and go back home to Mexico and hang out and catch up with people and come back.
For the busy season.
Right. Yeah. And you have to be able to make the hours on the other side of the year to be able to afford to do that. It's not a factory situation. And really people, they decry factory farming. If you don't want factory farming, don't treat farming like a factory.
And to be clear, no one's arguing that obviously, if they could get time and a half, if the farms could afford to pay them time and a half over 40 hours, obviously the farm workers would prefer that, yeah. Right? If they were working 50 hours anyway, they would obviously prefer for those last 10 hours. But you're saying that the farms, there's many farms that absolutely cannot afford it. Is it even possible to legislate something where by farm size, like a farm of a certain size, you pay overtime over 40 hours a week, a farm under that size, you don't have to up until 50 hours? Could that be a compromise? Is that too hard?
Where would you pick the threshold and how would
you
do that?
Well, you tell me. What is a big farm versus a small farm?
It doesn't even necessarily, in my view, have to do with size per se, as it does with how the farm is structured. How is it managed? And I would say with this issue of overtime in particular, you know, it's causing everyone to struggle. But the smaller farms, more than anyone, like we're talking about, larger farms have the systems in place to manage around this. While it's not easy, it may be more doable in one shape or form for a larger farm. At the same time, what's the upshot if a farm can't afford to do it? You know, the idea is, well, somebody's just got to cough up the money. For one, farmers are price takers. We've heard that probably, if you heard conversations about farming and economics, you probably heard that phrase. It means farmers can't pass something along. If Home Depot has a new mandate put on them that causes their labor costs to go up, they spread that cost out over what they're selling because they have control of the price for the products that they sell. Farms don't. They have to take what the market will bear. And it's a global market. We're competing not just against other states. We're competing against, you know, farming, food production around the globe. So what happens then if you can't compete, if you can't make it work here in Washington State? That food production goes elsewhere. And that's the scariest thing that's happening with our food system right now. We squabble over these minute details, really in the grand scheme of things, about all these particulars of how farming is done, how farming is regulated here in Washington State. But we're pushing farming right to the brink where if you can't do it here anymore, and it's already happening,
yeah,
it's leaving. And our food is increasingly being produced in foreign countries where, do they pay overtime there? You know, fruits like we grow here in Washington State can also be grown in Mexico. We're hearing about people making $11 a day working on farms in Mexico.
Yeah.
What are the other labor standards? What are the environmental standards? What's the carbon footprint to grow that in a foreign country, then ship it back here to Washington State? And I think everybody would probably agree that they value local food. But they have to realize some of the policies that people are supporting right now is the enemy number one of keeping food local. 2023 is estimated to be the first year where the United States is a net importer of food. We need to take that seriously.
Well, I think you made a good point earlier that right now it's this one-size-fits-all solution. When you have an industry that is so, so different and has these really busy peak periods. And what I also think is interesting about this, I mean, I think it's a reasonable debate to have. I think that both sides can have some good arguments on, yeah, over 40 hours a week, you got to pay them overtime. It doesn't matter if it's for 12 right. weeks a year. But the issue here is, rather than have that conversation about everything that you just laid out and all the things at play, they always want to go back to racism. They always going to want to go back to race and, you know, to telling these farm workers, well, you don't know what you're talking about. Rather than have a conversation like this where they really hear them out, look at all the factors that are at play. So it's a disappointing way to frame a bill that you don't like by just saying, ah, it's racist.
Well, and that I think that's what was the most troubling to me, because, again, hey, are we listening to the people testifying during a hearing? It's not about the lawmakers' perspectives on it. They're supposed to be gathering information and perspective. And if people disagree, great. Let's have that debate. And it is a debate that could be had. And there are lots of things that go into this. And people may say, well, this whole system is screwed up. And really it is, where farmers don't have the ability to pass costs on. But how are you going to change that? And who's going to get hurt in the process? If it's, revolution, we're going to force this down people's throats and make things change. Well, who becomes the victim then? Well, as it's playing out right now, it's the farm workers. This is a social justice issue of farm workers being hurt. Again, we can have that debate. Let's hash it out. But then to put your thumb on the scale, to manipulate people's words, suggest they don't know what they're talking about because, I don't know, they're testifying in Spanish. It not healthy whatsoever.
Not at all. Dylan Honkoop, we appreciate the time. Anything else that you think people ought to know about what's happening in our farming communities?
Well, I think what we were talking about just a moment ago, as far as farming leaving Washington State and leaving the United States, is the thing that people need to be paying attention to. It's almost a perfect is the enemy of the good situation here in our food system, in our country, in Washington State in particular right now. Washington State has some of the most stringent regulations, across the board. You name the issue of anywhere in the country, and certainly then of just about anywhere in the world. That's great. Okay, we have very safe food. We're protecting the environment. We're getting more sustainable. Can farms get better? Absolutely. And they have been getting better. But if we push that so hard that the upshot is that food production leaves, we're harming the bigger goal here. And that's what people need to be asking themselves and thinking about. A lot of this stuff is peddled by fear, food fear, because it is so personal. And what am I putting into my body? And it's part of our lifestyle. It's part of humanity. Food is such a foundational thing. So people care about it. And it's been very easy, like we talked about bougie food trends at the beginning, it's very easy for those to be leveraged by people with an axe to grind or a political game to play or, honestly, money to be made to push this food discussion, whatever it happens to be on a given day, push it around and misinform people about the reality of what's happening with food in our country. So my conclusion would be, hey, any of these issues, be asking questions. Ask what's really going on. Not that you have to take the farmer's word as gospel. Ask them the hard questions too. Again, farming can always get better. But think about what the real big picture impact is of what we're doing.
I love it. Very well said. And we don't want our government regulating our way out of a reliable local food supply. That's the opposite of the direction we should be going. Dylan, thanks so much. Make one more plug for your podcast.
It's the Real Food, Real People podcast. You can find it on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, all the socials, and on your podcast platforms as well, Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all of those.
Okay, we'll end by reading some comments from all of you. Specifically, on Friday's show, I offered a commentary about this controversy over Matt Walsh, the Daily Wire conservative commentator, who just had this what I thought was a really kind of cruel commentary about Dylan Mulvaney, who's a high-profile trans activist.
Dylan, if that is the most attractive you will ever look, then I don't even want to imagine what you'll look like when you're at your ugliest. You do not pass as an attractive woman or as a woman at all. Even with 50 pounds of makeup and plastic surgery and clever lighting tricks, even then you still cannot escape what you really are and what you will always be. You have successfully shed whatever parts of you were masculine, perhaps, at least on the surface. Nobody would ever describe you as masculine or manly, so you've got that going. But your femininity quotient has not increased at a rate commensurate with the loss of your masculinity. You may not be masculine, but you also aren't feminine. Instead, you are weird and artificial. You are manufactured and lifeless. You are unearthly and eerie. You are like some kind of human deepfake. That's what you are.
And my point about that commentary is that I don't see that as productive. I don't think that that's the way that you take the movable middle on this issue over to your side. I mean, it just seemed cruel to me. So some comments from you guys. Let's see. Matt Gilbert on Patreon. Walsh was cruel, but he wasn't wrong. More women should be pissed off at Dylan for telling them what the female experience is. And I don't disagree. I mean, I saw Dylan Mulvaney do this video where he was talking about tampons. And it's like, okay, if you want to take all the parts of womanhood, including the absolute worst part, and that is getting your period, and pretend that you get it and use a tampon or whatever, I mean, fine. But I do agree that it's a little insulting for someone who's like suffered through years of periods. Sorry, yes, we have period talk on the Undivided Podcast. I do find it insulting for someone who was born a man to try to act as if like they know that part of being a woman. Hugh said, cruel indeed, stand for personal freedom, then denigrate those who exercise personal freedom. Cherry-picking principle standards is what binds the far left and the far right. Totally agree on that as well. Is if you're an adult and you want to transition into a different gender than the one you were born, you know, by all means. The conversation I think Matt Walsh should stick to and that I try to stick to is I just don't support any sort of life-altering surgery for youth. Now, what I support is a parent's right to be a part of that decision-making, and I've been very vocal about Washington State trying to cut parents out. I find it very problematic, completely inappropriate, and dangerous. Let's see, Chris, everyone saying that Walsh's mean wasn't necessarily wrong. His comments definitely weren't compliments, but I haven't seen anyone saying that they are incorrect. Dylan removed all of his masculinity and is still no more a woman than Rachel Dolezal was black. Of course, Rachel Dolezal was the white woman who pretended to be black and was the head of the NAACP in Spokane. Kevin, we are all a product of our life experiences. I did not grow up in the same city or block, and I had different parents. And I watched different TV shows and had different friends. I did not experience the life changes, challenges others did. How in the crap would another person be expected to have the same thoughts or opinions on every issue facing us? As a society, as humans, we should all be interested in hearing other ideas and understanding they come from a different point of view. This, of course, is assuming it is an honest opinion and not a party talking point, which I have no time or interest in. This leads me to Matt. He did what I hate about many progressives. Rather than a discussion or making an actual point, he lashed out. Dylan says so many things that are so wrong, particularly related to children, but there is a massive difference between debating a topic versus attacking over a topic. One respects a human despite having a different view. The other steps away from humanity. I totally agree, Kevin. I could not have said it any better myself. I think you have to have some humanity, some empathy, rather than resorting to, you know, the cheap, easy attacks. You know, there are a lot of salient points that Matt Walsh can and has made about the transgender issue, particularly when it comes to youth. And that's how you win hearts and minds, not with these personal sort of attacks. So that was my perspective on it as well. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. You know, I had somebody comment on my Facebook post about I wish you'd beg for money less and you know, do more content. It's like, well, I have to, if I don't beg for money, I can't do any content. So if you've been listening for free, but you'd like to become an Undivided subscriber for $5 a month, I'd love to have you. Yes, this is me begging for money. You can sign up at patreon.com/undivided. That's patreon.com/undivided. Or you can become a contributor on my Locals community, brandycruz.locals.com. For subscribers, I will see all of you on our subscriber-only show on Wednesday.